The academic universe has three groups, really. Mostly the Second Amendment, let's call them advocates, who have a vested interest in vindicating an individual right to have guns. The bystanders, who look on with puzzlement and amusement to the debate. And let's call them the liberal me-tooers, who are liberal constitutional law professors who've said without, it seems to me, intensive study that the Second Amendment advocates are right. And I do detect a little bit in the liberal me-tooers, at least a little bit of an effort to establish their own bona fides by showing agreement with a position which is a little counterintuitive for them. My coming view is that the individual right to bear arms reflects the success of an extremely aggressive and resourceful social movement, and has much less to do with good standard legal arguments than appears. We have seen an unbelievable transformation in the culture of the Second Amendment in a short time. As late as the early 1990s, Warren Burger, Chief Justice of the United States, Republican appointee and well-known conservative, said on the NewsHour that the Second Amendment right to bear arms, the claim that it creates an individual right, is one of the greatest pieces of fraud, I repeat the word fraud, on the American public by special interest groups that I have ever seen in my lifetime. Burger said a year later, the Second Amendment doesn't create a right to have firearms at all. It's impossible to understand the current debate without lingering over Berger's words. Imagine if Chief Justice Roberts went on the NewsHour to say the claim that there's a right to same-sex marriage is one of the greatest frauds perpetrated on the American public by a special interest group in our lifetime. That would be an astounding event, which suggests that Berger, a cautious person, was not trying to intervene into a constitutional debate by speaking inappropriately off the bench about his views. He was instead attempting just to capture the conventional wisdom, attempting to say what was so well known as a fact that to state it in public wasn't to say anything controversial at all. Flash forward, if you would, to just this March, when the prestigious U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, the second most important court in the land, embraced with great confidence the view that Berger has described as a fraud. What has happened here? We've seen such a sea change that on pages of law reviews, the view that Berger described as a fraud is now described as the standard model, capital S, capital M, in the pages of good law reviews. What has happened here? Was Berger just wrong? I'm going to try to approach this question with some methodological comments, and that is to come to terms with the Second Amendment, we need to have, don't we, a theory of constitutional interpretation. So let's just notice that there seem to be four that have helped to organize constitutional thought over the past century and more. The first, which we can find in the opinions of Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, is originalism, which tries to understand the Constitution's meaning by identifying the original public meaning of the document. And that would give us an inroad into the Second Amendment debate. It would help explain what it is that people who disagree about the Second Amendment are disagreeing about. There's a second view, let's just call it bipartisan restraint, which was prominent among conservative thinkers in the period of the Warren Court. It still has a degree of prominence among conservative thinkers today. The hero of bipartisan restraint is Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who believed that the court should strike things down as unconstitutional only when they clearly and beyond any doubt violated the document. The bipartisan restraint view has an obvious inclination, at least with respect to the Second Amendment. The third position, let's call it perfectionism, which probably was the Warren Court's approach to constitutional law and probably is the approach embodied in Roe against Wade, the efforts of those who do seem to want the Supreme Court to rule that same-sex marriages must be recognized. The perfectionists believe that the Constitution's text deserves respect. So there's something that you're perfecting to which you have to be faithful. That is a text and a tradition. But they also believe that it's legitimate and maybe required for the court to perfect the situation by making it as good as it possibly can be. A fourth approach is usually my favorite, and that is minimalism. And we minimalists like smallness in two different ways. We like judicial decisions in the most controversial domains, at least, that are narrow in the sense that they don't go far beyond the facts of the controversy, and also that are shallow in the sense that they don't make the most ambitious claims or resolve the deepest controversies that divide Americans. The minimalists think that shallowness has a place in constitutional law, unlike in the classroom and romantic relationships, where shallowness is frequently a vice. And minimalists like shallowness because they believe that it serves a great goal of a diverse society, which is to make agreement possible where agreement is necessary, and to make agreement unnecessary where agreement is not possible. What I'm going to be suggesting, the upshot of all this, is that the Second Amendment movement that we're seeing that I think might well win in the Supreme Court soon is a form of perfectionism, which is dressed up in originalist guise. So my tentative conclusion is that the astounding reversal in the conventional wisdom in a very short time purports to be an effort to recover the original understanding, but it has much more in common actually with the gay rights movement in constitutional law than it does with Madisonianism. And the irony of it is that the gay rights movement has a quite insistent moral principle, which whether or not it's entitled to ultimate acceptance has a claim on our attention given the arc of constitutional law over generations. The movement for a strong individual right under the Second Amendment can't claim quite the pedigree that the gay rights claims do, though we minimalists are very nervous about both forms of perfectionism. Okay, we're going to start by looking at the text of the Second Amendment, which provides in full, this isn't a long text, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. At first glance, there are two possible readings of the Second Amendment for English speakers. The first would say that this creates an unambiguous individual right. There's no puzzle here to be solved. The operative clause says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, which does raise questions about what kinds of regulation would be legitimate, to be sure, but which doesn't leave any kind of doubt about the individuality of the rights that are safeguarded by the amendment. The competing view emphasizes the preamble and suggests that the Second Amendment is unusual, not unique, but unusual in the sense that it comes equipped with its own explanation or purpose. And the suggestion is that the reference to the purpose delimits the scope of the right, which is to protect the well-regulated militia. So the notion would be a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state informs what the right of the people is. So on the collective rights view, which is textually possible, individual rights, individual citizens don't have a right to bear guns, to shoot rabbits, or to even to safeguard their houses against marauders. But the national government has to respect the right of the people, taken as a collectivity, to maintain organized militias for the common defense. That would be the idea. Now, suppose we are textualists in the sense that we believed that the Constitution has to be construed in a way that respects the meaning of its words. And we had all better be textualists I think. Otherwise, we're not interpreters. Stare at these words all you like, and you will not be able to be certain about which interpretation to choose of the two that are straightforward for modern English readers. Duke Law professor and University of Chicago visitor at one point, William Van Alstyne, an honest broker of constitutional meaning, got it right, I think, in suggesting no provision of the Constitution causes one to stumble quite so much on a first reading or second or third. In fact, Van Alstyne might have understated it. No provision of the Constitution, certainly in the domain of individual rights, is as mysterious as this one to the textuals. This is the Constitution's most mysterious right. If we are textualists, who are when stymied originalists too, we at least have a path for analysis. And this is the path that attracted Judge Silberman for the D.C. Circuit, and it would undoubtedly interest every member of the court, and acutely interest at least two members. So history will play a huge role in the debate once it gets to the Supreme Court, as it has played the dominant role in the academic discussions in the last 20 years. The first question we want to be able to answer is, what's meant by the right to keep and bear arms? What does that mean? Keep and bear. Presently, to an English reader, this means to own and carry, doesn't it? Keep and bear. But it turns out historically that this seems to have been a technical phrase in the sense that it referred to weapons in connection with military uses. You do not bear arms if you carry a rifle to shoot rabbits. This doesn't conclude the originalist debate, but it's suggestive. It indicates that military uses of guns, as opposed to hunting or purely private self-defense, may well be what's signaled by the words keep and bear arms, if those terms are actually a term of art. We want to ask, if we're originalists, what is the militia? This is puzzling to many modern readers, isn't it? What is the militia? There are state militias now. I think every state authorizes militias. I think about half of states have militias, but if there are more than 10 people in the room who actually know people in militias, count me surprised. State militias do not have anything like the prominence they did in the founding period, a point to which we shall return. A constitutional amendment proposed in the Virginia Ratifying Convention offers a clue about the original understanding. It said the following: the people have the right to keep and bear arms. Familiar phrase. A well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. This phrasing suggests, doesn't it, that the militia is the body of the people. That is, it's able-bodied males who might be or have been trained and enlisted on the state's behalf. With that point, we might be converging on some version of the individual rights view in the following sense: the view that individuals do have the right to have guns, at least so far as gun ownership enables us to band together to defend ourselves. Not on this view against the national government, though possibly that as well, but against invaders. Okay, this reading, and we're trying to put the individual rights view in its most plausible form, this fits pleasingly with the civil republican tradition that greatly influenced the founding generation and starts to make sense of why the right to bear arms might be historically attractive from the founders' point of view. Republicans believed that a professional or standing army could endanger liberty because of its separateness from the people. From the standpoint of civic republicanism, an engaged and armed citizenry is the best way of protecting the national defense. It's a sibling on this view, the right to keep and bear arms, to the right to free speech and the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. We the people could be sovereign as so far as we could speak out, petition the national government for help, and defend ourselves, maybe even against it. Further supporting the pro-gun reading, We're trying to make the original, this case, powerful. Blackstone, a big influence on the founders, referred to the right to bear arms as a public allowance under due restrictions of the natural right of resistance and self-preservation when the sanctions of society and laws are found insufficient to restrain the violence of oppression. The statement under due restrictions is suggestive, indicating that, like the right to free speech, the individual right to keep and bear arms might be subject to reasonable limitations, but it suggests there is a right that is of resistance and self-preservation. Joseph Story, Supreme Court Justice and a very influential early commentator, said, "The right to keep and bear arms has been justly considered as the palladium of the liberties of a republic." Note his word republic, since it offers a strong moral check against the usurpation and arbitrary power of rulers. So too, some state constitutional provisions seemed clearly to create individual rights in a way that fortifies the notion that the national document does that too. Pennsylvania's constitution seems the clearest of all, and that would matter. Pennsylvania, important state then, and still now, their constitution says, "The right of the citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state shall not be questioned," without any kind of preamble, suggesting there's an individual right, the palladium of the liberties of a republic, Blackstone's right of resistance and self-preservation. A minority report in Pennsylvania objecting to ratification of the Constitution, this was before the Bill of Rights was added, referred broadly to the people's right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and their own state, or the United States, or for the purpose of killing game. That seems, doesn't it, like a smoking gun in favor of the individual rights position, suggesting that hunting is itself part of the set of activities for which the individual right has been created. Okay, it's misleading, though, to take quotations out of context. And the original sources, once they're put together, start to look more ambiguous than they do at first glance. Blackstone's discussion of the right to bear arms and its connection with the right of resistance goes on to link that right with the ban on standing armies, an idea which is mysterious today, isn't it? I'm going to get to it in a moment. "Wherever standing armies are kept up," Blackstone said, "and the rights of the people to keep and bear arms is prohibited, if not already annihilated, is on the brink of destruction." Blackstone thus linking very closely the individual right to bear arms with the ban on standing armies. Taken as a whole, Story's own discussion emphasizes the uses of the militia more than it does an individual right to have guns. North Carolina's constitution reads very differently from Pennsylvania's. It says, "The people have a right to bear arms for the defense of the state. And as standing armies in time of peace are dangerous to liberty, they ought not to be kept up." If we read Pennsylvania's seemingly unambiguous provision against the backdrop of North Carolina's reference to the standing army, the right of the citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state shall not be questioned starts to become less clear than it did at first glance, doesn't it? What does that mean exactly? Does that mean that people can bear arms in lieu of a standing army, rather than creating an individual right? There was in the Pennsylvania Minority Report a reference to the right to bear arms for purpose of killing game. Apparently, there's no other reference anywhere in the founding period that links the right to bear arms with the right to hunt. That's the only one, suggesting that it's an anomaly rather than representative. There are further puzzles. The Tennessee Supreme Court, writing in 1840, against the backdrop of the founding experience, which was still fresh, and a quick few decades of experience with its interpretation, summarized in the following way. The real object of the right to keep and bear arms is the defense of the public and thus refers to military use. It follows, the court says, that a hunter may carry his rifle for every day for 40 years, and yet it would never be said of him that he had borne arms. Much less could it be said that a private citizen bears arms because he has a dirk or a pistol concealed under his clothes or a spear in a cane. What I'm emphasizing is not the acuity of the Tennessee Supreme Court, who knows about that, but its confidence in its judgment about what the meaning of the phrases were in an opinion where the experience of ratification was still fresh and when a summary was what was sought. Actually, for the individual rights position, things get more deeply puzzling still. For many constitutional problems, the founding era discussions seem familiar, or at least familiar enough, I think. Modern readers, lawyers first approaching the problem, people who are clerking for judges initially trying to understand things, it's not so hard to get into the debate over the power to make war and its distribution between the president and Congress. The nature of the right to a jury trial, the composition of the Senate, these aren't deeply mysterious. But for the Second Amendment, we quickly enter a different nation whose problems are so different from our own that it's very difficult to figure what they're talking about. In the Federalist Papers, Madison argued, and this was a crucial passage in the Federalist Papers, that the fear of a standing army was baseless. Because any such army, a standing army on the part of the national government, would be badly outnumbered by, quote, a militia amounting to near half a million of citizens with arms in their hands, offered by men chosen from among themselves, fighting for their common liberties, and united and conducted by governments possessing their affections and confidence. It's hard to think our way back, isn't it, into a world in which standing armies maintained by the states were seen as an indispensable and effective military safeguard against the might of the national government. We do have a National Guard. That's a problem for Madison, not a solution. And states, as noted, continue to authorize their militias. But do you know anyone who is in one? Do you know if your state has one? A historian seeking to recapture the original understanding of the Second Amendment said, if we were really trying to be faithful to that, we would have to recreate the world of the Minuteman. A nightmare, he says, in which states would mandate that all Americans, probably now women as well as men, if we're really originalist men, would be required to receive firearms training and to possess their own military-style assault weapons. If this puzzle isn't getting to you, let's try to get toward the original meaning by looking at the first draft of Madison's Second Amendment, which he wrote. It says, a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people being the best security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But no person religiously scrupulous shall be compelled to bear arms. Huh? If contemporary Americans were writing a new constitution, would any sane person suggest this language? Of course we could imagine a proposed right to keep and bear arms, but what are the rest of the words doing? But no person religiously scrupulous shall be compelled to bear arms? Madison's draft is unmistakably focused on the military. Without that focus, it would be senseless to follow the right with an exemption for those with religious scruples. If the ratified Second Amendment is substantively identical to Madison's draft, then Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Jack Rakove, an honest broker of constitutional meaning, might be right to affirm that the purpose of the Second Amendment is to vindicate the proposition, or commonplace, that liberty fared better when Republican polities relied upon a militia of citizen soldiers for their defense, rather than the risk the dire consequences of sustaining a permanent military establishment. Ponder over the relevance of that to current debates, where, sure, we have a permanent military establishment with the equivalent of a standing army. In the debate in the Second Amendment in the House of Representatives, Eldridge Geary said, "What, sir, is the use of a militia? It is to prevent the establishment of a standing army, the bane of liberty." What seems to be emerging from this view is that the original understanding is not adequately captured by either of our two principal contenders. This is not an individual right in the sense that the Second Amendment advocacy scholars urge, nor is this a collective right in the sense that the Second Amendment advocacy scholars' angriest critics respond. It's instead a civic right designed to guarantee that citizens can keep and bear arms to the extent that's necessary for them to discharge their responsibilities to participate in a well-regulated militia. This would mean that on the original understanding, the national government could not take arms out of the hands of citizens to the extent that those arms are part of the operation of militias. But insofar as modern gun control legislation has nothing to do with that, it's very difficult to figure out how to map the original understanding onto the current practices. Consider, for example, that part of the law of the District of Columbia that requires citizens to keep lawfully owned shotguns bound at home by a trigger lock. Suppose that a citizen objects, as citizens have been objecting, that the trigger lock interferes with his efforts at self-defense against criminals. What on earth does that have to do with the Second Amendment as originally understood? My tentative suggestion is that the individual right to have guns, as it's being conceptualized now, is best taken as a contemporary creation and a reflection of current fears, not a reading of civic-centered founding debates. Modern gun owners who are invoking the Second Amendment on the basis of a principle they favor are perfectionists, not so different from older people who tried unsuccessfully, I'm pleased to say, to get the Equal Protection Clause read to strike down mandatory retirement laws. Okay, originalists at this point, I think, should be inclined to reject the claim for an individual right. They have some more work to do. The bipartisan restraint people know exactly what to do. The document, and read in its historical context, lacks the kind of unambiguous meaning that would support a Holmesian rejection of gun control legislation. But we have a group of minimalists here who are interested in thinking about other things. And they're interested, in particular, in two questions. First, what's our tradition been in terms of judicial practice extending over time? And second, minimalists want to know, following the great conservative Edmund Burke, what have our traditions been like apart from what's happened in the courts? How has our culture understood the Second Amendment, not just in the founding era, but through the arc of our history? Well, in terms of judicial developments, it is striking and noteworthy that well over two centuries since the founding, the Supreme Court has never suggested that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to have guns. Not once. It would be amazing, though, given that fact, though don't be surprised if the first time it happens is in the next 3 or 4 years. The leading decision thus far is from 1939, a case called United States against Miller, which bans possession of a sawed-off shotgun. The court unanimously rejected the trial court's conclusion that the ban violated the Second Amendment, The court said the obvious purpose of the Second Amendment was to assure the continuation and render possible the effectiveness of the militia, and that its declaration and guarantee must be interpreted and applied with that end in view. The court said there was no evidence showing that the possession or use of a sawed-off shotgun at this time has some reasonable relation to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia. End of case. This passage does not lack ambiguity, but it seems to suggest at a minimum that Congress has complete power over weapons that are not ordinarily used by the military. It also seems to reject the strongest versions of the individual rights interpretation with its purposive burger-like reference to the militia. It's also important to pause over the fact that if the Second Amendment creates an individual right, then it ought to be incorporated via the 14th Amendment and applied to the states. But the Supreme Court early ruled that the Second Amendment has not been incorporated and applied and does not apply to the states, and the Supreme Court has never questioned that judgment. Well, we might think that the early pronouncement by the Supreme Court have been outrun by recent research, and it's possible that that's so. But the minimalist would like to know how has our legal system outside of the Supreme Court understood the Second Amendment. And it turns out, until very recently, we have an unbroken pattern, which is that the Second Amendment, in the federal courts at least, has been taken not to create an individual right to possess a firearm. This can be found in multiple Court of Appeals decisions. It was not until the 21st century that federal courts adopted the pro-individual rights interpretation, with one in 2001 and another in 2007. Speaking in terms of the arc of our legal development, this is Second Amendment revisionism, isn't it, rather than continuity with a tradition. What about social practices? Well, the Burkean and Burkean minimalists who want to build slowly and incrementally from past decisions in a way that's closely in tune to what people have actually done, which is why the minimalists don't like striking down bans on the use of the word under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, and why minimalists are very skeptical about the claim that the government can't recognize, take your pick, the existence or people's belief in the existence of God, on the ground that that kind of neutral reading, neutral between religion and non-religion of the religion clauses, runs over like a truck many decades of practice, which has gone the other way. So too, the Burkeans are interested to know what in the last 100 years plus has been done. Since the Civil War, one or another form of gun regulation has been common, and it has been rarely challenged even on constitutional grounds. So one recent reading of the last century and a half suggests the following pattern. A substantial body of laws regulating weapons possession and a small number of opinions addressing Second Amendment objections to such laws, with no opinions from federal appellate courts invalidating any modern regulations, and an apparent lack of any interest by the Supreme Court in taking fundamental Second Amendment issues. This suggests that whatever the view of the founding generation, ours has been a tradition in which the Second Amendment imposes indiscernible or very weak restrictions on the power of the government to regulate use and possession of weapons. The minimalist at this point will be very nervous about any vindication of the Second Amendment right as conceived by the individual rights crowd. The minimalist will think this is way out of step with existing precedents. It looks like a bolt from the blue. It doesn't look very incremental, and it is out of step with a tradition rather than an accord with it. The minimalist, though, is disinclined as well to reject a deeply felt commitment on the part of a large segment of the American Republic. There would be a form of prudence and maybe charity as well in Supreme Court rulings that bracket the deepest questions about constitutional meaning and attempt, if fairly possible, to leave open the option of holding at some point in the future that the Second Amendment creates some individual right to own guns. So the minimalist will be drawn to the view that precedents and history foreclose an individual right, but because of the minimalist interest in narrowness and shallowness, the minimalists were very hard, as in the case involving Under God, to leave the issue undecided. I'm essentially done. My major submissions are, first, textualism just doesn't help us. The claim by those who believe that this is an individual right, that the Second Amendment speaks plainly on behalf of that position, is a fraud. The claim by the collective rights crowd that the purpose clause of the Second Amendment clarifies that this is a collective right rather than an individual right is equally fraud. The National Rifle Association, insofar as it invokes the original understanding, can't be accused of fraud. There's material in the history which is plausibly supportive of their claim. But at least my current view, based on the history, is that the original understanding does not justify the contemporary understandings of the Second Amendment pressed by individual gun owners. The entanglement with the ban on standing armies is just too clear and too firm to support the view that non-military uses of guns are protected by the Second Amendment as against official regulation. The minimalist wants to rule as narrowly as possible, but finds it troubling to preserve the existence of an individual right insofar as it's hard to find anything in our cultural practices, as opposed to the beliefs of many, to defend the preservation of the right. But the minimalist is going to work hard to try to do that out of humility and respect for fellow citizens. We're left with one candidate to explain the driver of the Second Amendment truck, and that is perfectionism. This is an influential social movement which is deeply committed in principle to an individual right to bear arms. There are arguments that are plausible as a matter of social science, certainly, that restrictions on gun ownership do very little to protect people, and it might on balance not protect them. The claim that gun control is a fantastic way of reducing the problem of violence in the United States appears not to be sufficiently supported by social science. I'm not speaking to that. But the movement is perfectionist in character. The first oddity is that this form of perfectionism, as briefly signaled at the beginning, lacks the moral appeal of the forms of perfectionism that produced the ban on apartheid in the United States and the ban on sex discrimination by state and federal government. At least in those circumstances, there was a strong claim from political realities and moral principle that the best reading of the Equal Protection Clause was inconsistent with racial subjugation and with the prohibition on equality between men and women as a matter of state and federal law. This form of perfectionism has all of the fervor of those movements, I think, but lacks the moral appeal. The second oddity is that this movement, unlike those, is wrapped far too confidently in historical garb. So, tentative thoughts you've just heard. I'm eager for questions, objections, puzzles.
Just to help us facilitate our imagination of this mysterious article, just what are the kinds of arms regulation that would be regarded by the court as blatant infringement of the people's right to maintain a well-regulated militia?
Okay, if after the founding period, the national government said that the states can't have militias, or they can have militias, but they can't be armed, that would be a clear violation. So if the federal government now said that the states can't have militias, or that the state militias can't have guns, that would be a clear violation. Then the question is, what can we do to understand contemporary gun control regulation as in the same ballpark? In the District of Columbia, that's the case. There's a quite draconian ban, which seems to be a flat ban on owning guns in homes. And it's not crazy to say that that defangs the citizens' ability to defend themselves against what? The national government, in a way that makes impossible the District of Columbia's having a militia. And one can say this, but there's something a little wild about that, isn't it? I mean, these are the sorts of sentences you could write, but you might think to yourself, what am I talking about? That in the District of Columbia, people can own handguns at home, and the reason they can own that is that allows them to band together and fight against the national government if it attacks them. That's what Madison was concerned about. Even that reading, while not implausible historically, it's very confusing because Madison saw this as closely enmeshed with the ban on a standing army. But now we have the Army and the Navy and the Marines and the Air Force. And so what are we imagining, and we're trying to be originalists, in striking down this ban? We're imagining that people in the District of Columbia will have guns with which they can fight off the Marines and the Army? Our world is so radically different from theirs. Now, the D.C. Circuit was concerned in the case from last March about rendering the Second Amendment a dead letter, fearful that the interpretation that rejects the strong individual rights view makes the Second Amendment meaningless. And that is a reasonable question, to say the only office of the Second Amendment now is to prevent the national government from stopping states from having militias or from dearming the state militias. But it may be that is what the Second Amendment did. That's what it did, and it still does that.
Yeah. Sabrina. Do you think there's support for the collective rights view and the fact that under the original enumerated powers, the federal government would have had very limited ability to ban individual ownership of guns anyway?
Well, I think there's the following legitimate claim, which is any national regulation has to fall within an enumerated power. So I haven't said anything about the possibility that federal gun control could be beyond the power Congress has under the Commerce Clause. And we could imagine forms of that which would run into the court's decisions, say, in the Violence Against Women Act case, where generalized criminal legislation whose relationship to commerce is unclear. So that's clearly right. But I think your question is more subtle than that. Could we think that if the federal government originally lacked power over guns, it's not within the enumerated power, then doesn't that support the view that the Second Amendment is an individual right? I don't think so. I think the way the militia stuff was structured was a careful state and federal compromise in a way that is consistent with what I'm suggesting was a civic conception of the Second Amendment at its origins. And to get a hold of that, let's notice that the Second Amendment isn't the only place where the militia is referred to. The Constitution has the power, and try to think your way back into a world where this would be put in the nation's constitution. It has the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. What's that about? Well, it fits with the civic view. There's something called the militia, the state militias. Congress can call it forth to repel invasions. That fits beautifully with the notion this is all about standing armies. stopping standing armies. Congress also has the power, I think this does get very precisely at your question, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. So the national government's enumerated powers include two things. It can provide for calling forth the militia, and it can provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. And with the necessary and proper clause, there's probably a lot it can do. Yes, there. But the states retain power over the appointment of the officers. Think of Madison's reference to, don't worry about the federal government attacking, because the militias will be there to save the states, and then wonder about how to map that onto contemporary situation. The states retain the power of the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Now, this sounds a little like an unrecognizable world, but this one I think we can think our way back into once we know about the standing army concern. The states train the militia, and they appoint the officers. Congress can prescribe the discipline, organize and arm them, and call them forth. Congress does have enumerated powers, but they're restricted. That fits quite well with the civic understanding, doesn't it? That this is preserving Madison's concern, which was that the standing armies would be present to defeat the Republican goal of allowing citizen soldiers. We don't really have citizen soldiers in the same sense. So on this view, which those members of Congress who were talking about reinstituting a military draft, there's actually, I want to phrase this cautiously, there's a plausible view that they are recovering original constitutional understandings better than those who are saying there's an individual right to use guns to kill animals. The notion that Congress has the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, the militia, everyone knew what that meant, can organize, arm, and discipline the militia while states appoint officers, train them according to Congress's discipline. That suggests, as you say, there's a very careful allocation of authority between the state and the national government. This is a really big deal. And the allocation was one in which the right to keep and bear arms, on this view, was inextricably intertwined with militias. This makes more plausible something that to me had not seemed plausible originally. Originally, it seemed to me that the Pennsylvania provision was clear, at least. The Pennsylvania provision had no preamble, remember. It didn't read like the Second Amendment. It said that the right to keep and bear arms, the right of the citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state shall not be questioned. That seems, at first glance, very clear. And then we could go one of two ways. We could say, well, the national government, there's the preamble, which suggests the national government had a more limited function than Pennsylvania's. Or you could go the other way, that the Pennsylvania one, which looks like the operative clause of our Constitution's Second Amendment, suggests it really is an individual right. On this view, looking at Congress's power over the militia, Pennsylvania's apparently plain statement, the right of the citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state shall not be questioned, isn't so clear. It's about no standing armies. It's saying that citizens, the military force is in us, not in a them. And what does that have to do with at least most restrictions on gun ownership? Okay, one thing that's troubling for the argument I'm sketching is that suppose a state said people can't have guns at all. That might run into the original understanding, might it? Because that would render impossible state operating militias in which people have guns. Now, even that seems to me very confusing to think through, because the militia in which people have guns is all about no standing armies. We now have standing armies. Or if we have standing armies to enable people to protect themselves against the standing army, what a ridiculous thought. On the other hand, maybe the fact that people have guns ordinary citizens have guns is some deterrent against the national government coming and killing us. But this does seem preposterous. What we're talking about here must be about, when I say preposterous, I mean really it must be about contemporary concerns and fears rather than something that was driving Madison. Okay, the minimalist likes to do two things when the nation is deeply divided and when the minimalist is quite unsure what's right. If those conditions are both met, minimalist first wants not to take cases, wants to render things, to try to deny certiorari or to not to get to the merits. There are two, I think, good cases where the court did this. One was under God, under the Pledge of Allegiance, where you could write an opinion going either way in that. It's not so hard to do that. A lot of the justices who refused to, probably at least one of the justices who joined the opinion refusing to resolve the issue, thinks, I don't have a particular person in mind, but there's probably at least one who thinks privately, under God and the Pledge of Allegiance, that violates the Establishment Clause. And wanted not to resolve it because of the uproar it would create in a way that would offend citizens who deserve respect. So you could use a doctrine of justiciability or of denial of certiorari. So this would suggest the court shouldn't take the D.C. Circuit case. Even though the D.C. Circuit case did something very bold, and I believe far too confident in selecting a very controversial reading of history to strike down acts of Congress. The minimalists can't do that, the minimalists would like to resolve the question in a way that leaves the hardest questions unanswered. So we could imagine a gun control law that says people have to keep shotguns at home with trigger locks on. I'll say that whatever the meaning of the Second Amendment, the amendment isn't violated by this one. So even if there's an individual right, recall Blackstone and due restrictions, even in Pennsylvania, that minority report referred to reasonable restrictions. These are reasonable restrictions. So the minimalists would want to bracket that. But you're quite right that there will be situations which will hold the minimalist feet to the fire and the bracketing won't work. And the D.C. Circuit law may be sufficiently aggressive that that's so. So let me free associate a little bit here. If you think of the sex discrimination cases and Brown against Board of Education, Brown, unlike Roe, was not a bolt from the blue. In fact, there was a litigating strategy by Thurgood Marshall and colleagues that went case, so that by the time of Brown, segregation in the United States was like a building whose foundations had been removed. And a little press and it collapses. If the court had ruled in 1910 that segregation violates the Constitution, that would have been a social upheaval that was, the ground hadn't been prepared. Roe against Wade, by contrast, was a blow to democratic processes that didn't work with them and listen to them. In the area of sex discrimination, we now have, contrary to the original understanding, a robust ban on sex discrimination by the state or federal government. No equal protection clause, by the way, applies, to the national government. So the constitutional foundations of the ban on national sex discrimination from the originalist point of view are a real mystery. But that worked in minimalist fashion, case by case by case. It didn't come immediately. So the minimalists would like whatever happens to the Second Amendment to happen through a process of learning and democratic exchange rather than, pardon the metaphor, you know, a gunshot. So the D.C. Circuit case, which was had a high degree of ambition in it, that came from the Supreme Court. While sufficient numbers of Americans would approve of it, that it wouldn't be an upheaval, and while the, I believe, the social science case for gun control laws of the sort this interpretation forbids is weak enough that it's not, as a matter of policy, a horrifying event, still, as a matter of sound practice, it's it would look a lot like Roe against Wade. And what is keeping me puzzled about all this is the Berger early 90s current situation. The radical change in constitutional understandings in such a short time, where, mind you, the Chief Justice of the United States, conservative Republican appointee, said publicly, this is the greatest fraud committed on the American public in my lifetime, in a way that was meant to state a fact, not to express highly inappropriately a view on a then disputed constitutional issue. And now it's all changed. So this is not the short answer. The short answer is try to avoid the big question if you can, the minimalist wants. If you can't, then you're stuck. Well, the statement that the Second Amendment is not incorporated so as to apply to the states is meant as a statement of existing law. It's not meant as a normative statement. So under existing law, the Supreme Court has never said that the Second Amendment applies to the states, and it said the opposite. If this view holds, then states can regulate all they want, and the national government can't. And if anything like the view I've suggested is right, that's fine, because the federal government was the object of the Second Amendment. The concern was the federal government defanging the states. And so there is a plausible originalist view, contrary to the one to which I'm inclined, which says that the federal government remains defanged in this way, but the states aren't. When you say that the Second Amendment isn't incorporated, many Second Amendment advocates would say those are fighting words, taking the statement not as a description of current law, where that is accurate, but as the best interpretation. And on their view, the First Amendment is incorporated, the Fourth Amendment is incorporated. If we've incorporated the other rights, and basically we have a couple little exceptions, the Second Amendment is incorporated too. And here's a point for the Second Amendment advocates, a concession to them, something on which I think they are correct. If the Second Amendment does create an individual right rather than a collective right or a civic right, then incorporation does follow. So if they're correct in their principal submission, then they're probably correct on the incorporation issue too. That's a great question. And part of the answer is at least that the founding generation was split on the standing army question. Many of the national government fans thought a standing army was indispensable and thought militia, you know, that's not enough. So many of them thought the state militias were ineffectual and had proved themselves ineffectual in the preceding decades. And what was needed was a standing army. So while the hatred of the standing army did emerge as a component of the compromise between state and federal relations. A flat ban, there was not a consensus in its favor. What there was a consensus in favor of was that a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. And what makes this particularly confusing is that that's inconsistent with existing practices.